You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Eric Kelting, with Complete Legal Services, specifically the Chief Operating Officer and co-founder of Complete Legal. How are you doing today, Eric?
I'm good. How are you, Sam?
Thanks for having me. Doing great. So I like to start off with kind of tell me about what is Complete Legal? When did you come aboard and what are you doing? What's some of the stuff you're doing there?
Yeah, we founded the company in 2014. We're a litigation support provider, e-discovery provider. Really what that means is that we're involved in the discovery process and trial process with attorneys. We gather data off of devices, put it into a format for lawyers to review as a part of litigation. And we have a number of services around reviewing those documents, producing them to opposing counsel, and then getting them ready for trial. And then our industry goes back 30, 40 years when things were just paper. And so we actually still have a division of our company that still prints and scans and digitizes old documents. We print millions of pages a year. Even though that has reduced over time, we still have to print a lot of stuff to go to trial. And so we're just there as a professional services company to litigators. Been in the industry since about 2006, worked for another company. We were bought and sold several times. It got to the point where we sat out our non-competes and launched our company in 2014. And here we are 10, 11 years into it.
For layman's, can you tell me about discovery and that process of getting the documentation prepped for trial? Because, I mean, that definitely seems to be its own sort of bear, right? There's a certain process and a certain format where everything is acceptable and what you can or can't tamper with to the extent of... Well, and then by contrast, what's always interesting to me is it's like you still need it on a format that the court can view, right? So if you have it in some weird, obscure format that anybody can view, we apparently at least allow export to a different format. So anyway, sorry, as much of the weeds as you care or interested to go into.
Remember, I'm the IT guy, not me, so I'll do my best. Yeah, I'm scared. I've got an IT guy or an attorney watching this podcast that's going to pick my answer apart, but... Really, the discovery process is the reviewing and exchanging of documents as it relates to litigation. So if I'm going to sue you, we're going to request documents where we feel like we've been wrong or there was a breach in contract. And so my lawyers are going to request from your lawyers a certain set of documents. You're going to have your team review them before you turn them over to me. You're going to review for privileged and things that aren't responsive to my request. And then you might have the same thing with me. You might also want my contracts and copies of emails and text messages. And so all of that communication, if you and I are in a lawsuit, all that communication is potentially relevant. That's what our lawyers are going to fight over. What should get to be reviewed and what is going to be turned over as evidence. In the old days, it was empty out the file cabinets, go to the records room of a corporation, dump out the files, scan them, copy them, literally photocopy them and exchange them. And now those documents, that digital correspondence, you know, that exists in texts and Teams chats and calendar invites and email, obviously, and all of the Microsoft documents. And then obviously, as you get into industries, specific industries like architecture, you might have like CAD drawings and proprietary systems, CRM data. So our industry has really had to evolve from the hard copy paper document being the only document that could exist to all sorts of different types of data. And that's not even questioning like the third dimension of data, which is like, when was it sent? When was it opened? Who authored it? All that kind of metadata behind the scenes data that we have access to. So our industry's really had to evolve a lot from paper to electronic. There is one of the reasons why we exist is that we try to normalize those documents and put them into a format for lawyers to review, for the judge to review. That's why I said you'd be amazed how much stuff gets printed, even though a lot of things weren't ever meant to be printed. Think of a gigantic Excel spreadsheet, right? It's not formatted to be 8.5 by 11. But a lot of times the courts want stuff printed in hard copy. And that can also bring its own challenge when it relates to text messages or Teams chats and getting that stuff down to 8.5 by 11 image, whether that's a PDF or a physical piece of paper can be a challenge, but definitely requested a lot and something that we've got to deal with as an industry.
Well, and it's a fascinating thought too, the quantity of things that you'd have to pull through, right? Because I mean, you think of an old school world with like a series of file cabinets. On one hand, you'd like to think it's easier. On the other hand, you made a great example. We've entered a world where texts, emails, you know, these are all data that we're sending and receiving on a regular basis without thinking about it. And then in the case of a court instant, pulling through all that to decide, for both parties to decide what is or isn't relevant to be admitted as evidence, that's got to sort of nightmare.
When I started this industry, it was common for lawyers to go down to like Iron Mountain and just comb through boxes and review all of the corporate records that are in question in a lawsuit. I often have to pause too and remind folks, like we work on cases where there's a voluminous amount of documents or data, right? So the average Joe walking the street who needs a lawyer for divorce or speeding tickets or basic criminal stuff or probate estate, we don't really do a lot of that litigation. We do a lot of civil litigation, environmental law, federal inquiries, white collar civil crime, where there's a lot of documents, a lot of data. And so, yeah, I mean, there is something clean about just grabbing a box of documents and scanning it, right? It's fairly simplistic. We've got a project right now. We're scanning 3,000 boxes of old 80s records from the 80s and 90s for a corporation. So to comb through that much information is it's literally doc by doc, page by page for whether we scan it and then the person whoever's going to review it. At least with data, you can throw technology at it. We can obviously go in and grab just certain email ranges, certain text message ranges, date ranges to certain people, Teams chats from you and me on a certain date. So you can be a lot more restrictive. And then since you have rich data, metadata, and rich text that you can actually comb through and use technology or some form of a machine assistance. Yes, there is some AI in our space, but there's also kind of the precursor to AI, which is still machine assistance and machine help. But you can definitely, the sources have increased. So we might need to go to your laptop, your cloud environment, your cell phone, everywhere where you keep data and documents, especially as it pertains to your business. But then once we get our hands on it, it's actually more usable than boxes and boxes of paper.
That's cool. So now let's start to kind of rewind the clock a little bit, Eric. So let's go back to right around the period when you were in high school.
Okay.
You think right around this time, I feel like that's when it's at its apex, sort of what college are you going to go to? You know, now you've probably moved past the notion of becoming a space cowboy into the world of what are you going to do for a job? And there's other people telling you, giving you ideas. What did you think you were going to do? Like, did you know you were going to run this company complete legal or...
I didn't know this industry existed until the day I interviewed in, you know, the mid-2000s. So I definitely didn't know I was going to be in this industry. I will tell you that I've reflected on this a lot. And even going back to middle school, I always knew I was going to be a business owner and entrepreneur. And whether that was just, I have a lot of vivid memories of daydreaming about things I wanted to do. And, you know, there was this old movie theater at the end of our street, two blocks from our house was this really old, like turn of the century movie theater. It had obviously gone out of business. Couldn't keep up with the larger theaters that were being built. And my mom's reminded me that I would just, as a kid, just spitball ideas that I could do with that empty building or that business or different things that I wish I could do. And just like, I was just fascinated with this, you know, dilapidated, deserted building of like, oh, if I could own that, or if I could get my hands on that, all the things I would do. And of course these are just raw ideas as a kid, but somewhere in middle school, yeah, I started to realize that I knew I was fascinated with business. I didn't know in what capacity. I mean, you don't really know at, you know, 13, 14, what the world of business means, but did some programs in high school. My first job was a lawn route, like so many other entrepreneurs. I printed up flyers and put them throughout my neighborhood and then developed a client list and, you know, had my route as a kid where I would load everything on my mower and push it up the hill, my gas can, my rake and all the stuff. And very vivid memories of kind of that experience. My mom reminding me that I didn't have to pay for the mower, that I didn't have to pay for gas, that those would be, you know, expenses in a lawn care business. Of course, at, you know, 14, I'm like, well, yeah, I can't afford gas. Well, you buy the gas, of course, your mom. But just that, you know, those simple little acts of just trying to teach me what it meant to actually run a business, and the expenses that I would have. I wouldn't just have revenue. And so, yeah, I think I, you know, through high school and as I went off to college, I just, you know, I was a pre-business major. I ended up going to KU and getting a, switching to the school of journalism to get an advertising degree. But I don't know what it was, but at a young age, I knew that I wanted to own and operate a business. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I just didn't. That was just a big TBD on what it was going to be until later in life. So
there's a decent bit to dig in there. So I, one of the things I want to jump into, because you had mentioned these are preformed ideas, right? In on the theater bit. What's your opinion on, you know, it seems like culturally we kind of glamorize the idea, right? We have Shark Tank. We have these whole shows where it's like, the idea is all that matters. And I remember even with my friends, you know, over a bar with a couple drinks, it was like we were always had this next big idea. And it was the idea that mattered. So the question being, what's your kind of, because I can already kind of sense you probably have an opinion there. What's your opinion on how, as a culture, we kind of worship the idea?
Yeah, I had a friend of mine years ago say ideas are cheap, right? It's what you do with them that matters. And so we can all sit around over cocktails and have ideas for the next business or the next app or the next software. And I mean, and ideas are important, right? I mean, obviously we've had some of the greatest minds of our, of the last 100 years have been visionaries with phenomenal ideas. But I think my buddy's point is like, it's great to have an idea, but like, when are you going to put that into action? What are you going to do about it? And that next step is the hard part. You're right. We do glamorize it on things like Shark Tank. And, you know, I have this idea, it's worth millions, but you know, an idea, and again, you have certain, in some industries and in some situations, ideas are very valuable, but for the most part, it takes action behind that. I still remember right before, we had just started the business. I was still working full time at a day job. I hadn't gone over to the business full time. I was getting ready to do that. I was talking to my eye doctor. I was in for an annual eye exam, and he recommended the book E-Myth. I think it's Michael Gruber, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. Check me on that. But I found that book fascinating because it was sounds like you've probably read it, but it just makes the point that, hey, you know, everyone is sensationalizes, you know, be your own boss, you know, have your own company, be your own boss.
You were right on the name, by the way.
What a lot of folks don't realize is that you're going to then perform your craft and have to run a business. And so if you're a baker and you want to be your own boss and have your own bakery, that's great. You're going to bake and then you're going to have to keep books, you're gonna have to market, you're gonna have to sell, you're gonna have to hire, you're gonna have to fire, you're gonna have to manage, you're gonna have to run a business and bake, you know, or lawn care or whatever. And it does apply to a lot of people in trades or in crafts, doctors, dentists, you name it. But I think that was a phenomenal book for me too, just to remember, like, we do romanticize being your own boss and having your own business and being in charge and having autonomy and control and all those things, but it comes with a price. Which is, you know, you actually have to do the work. And so, yeah, it takes more than just an idea, in my humble opinion. But
no, I agree wholeheartedly. So much more. So what is it that you knew you were going to be? You had this entrepreneurial spirit even in your younger years. So what kind of happened? Now let's go into college and you know, KU. Why the beeline?
Yeah, I did my first semester at Wichita State. Mm-hmm. And I took one of those kind of, I don't remember what the class was. It was like intro to life, right? It was one of those credits that didn't transfer. I'll date myself. We signed up for our first email address in that class, which I still have to this day. So I still have a Hotmail account because of it. But I remember I vividly remember in that class at that time, we were told employers were really valuing resumes, not just good grades and not just coursework and not just your degree, that you also needed a really strong resume to get internships, needed internships to get jobs and things like that. So that really resonated with me. I wasn't a great student. School doesn't come naturally to me. I didn't love attending class. That was probably one of the reasons why I wasn't a great student. But the resume, I set out to build a strong resume in college. I whatever that message resonated with me. And so every summer I had an internship, including like after my sophomore year. And then I transferred to KU at semester. I immediately started joining some organizations. I joined a business organization, AKSI. And then that semester I also applied to work at the ad staff at the newspaper. And so my sophomore year, I was a sales rep for the student newspaper. Can't remember however many of us there were. There's usually about 40, 50 kids on staff, on the ad staff. But I mean, it was a $1.2 million budget to run and print the paper and pay for the news staff and all the equipment and computers. And we got a little bit from the university, but most of it was through ad sales. And so I had a territory and I learned to sell and I learned to have revenue goals and have a budget and try and exceed those revenue goals. And those were skills I was learning as a kid in college. And I ended up working on that newspaper for 4 years, in management and in sales management and different roles on that staff, including the business manager, which kind of oversees the whole ad staff. And so, yeah, I don't know if I would have done all that if I hadn't got that message loud and clear my freshman year, but I definitely, for an extracurricular, I was drawn to it because it was, one, I met some of my best friends, right? It was a great social thing to be involved with. But looking back, I mean, I was at one point as business manager, I was running a $1 million business. And I think about, you know, doing that as a kid, because I was a kid, what a great experience that was for me and setting me up for success post-college. And as well,
when I even want to hear about ad sales, you know, take this as a compliment, Eric, but you don't strike me as a salesman.
I appreciate that.
And so I want to hear about that process. Are you a natural born salesman and is it an uphill battle for you? What did that look like? What was your magic?
Yeah, So it's fun. After college, I went into sales for a while. I started this industry in sales, but this industry is also, and really the role I was in was in account management. And so, no, I'm not a natural born salesperson. I hate cold calling. I literally clam up. I despise it. I'm horrible at it. And I'm really bad. I can't sell something I don't believe in, and I can't sell something to a client that I don't think is actually in their best interest. And so, account management, hospitality, taking care of people, doing the right thing, that does come naturally to me. And so if I'm in a situation where I believe in the product and I truly believe I'm helping the client, then yes, it's very organic. And we call them farmers versus hunters. I was not a good hunter. I could not go get new business. The thrill of the hunt does not excite me. But if you give me one user at one account, I can win over that whole account eventually just through hard work and determination, service, taking care of people, being nice. I mean, those are the things that do come naturally. And so I definitely have a background in sales, but it's not something that's that comes naturally to me. And as we've put our merger together and found lanes for myself and my partners, there's a reason why I ended up in the COO role, not CRO or CEO, right? So, I mean, I went to where my strengths are. But I do have a background in sales, college and post-college. So
can you tell me about your personality discovery throughout all this? It's a weird sort of question, but you're describing a world where, you know, you're right. You are in a bit more of a COO capacity, and you're describing farmer versus hunter. Are there personality tests that have helped guide you? Any particular coaches or mentors that really helped kind of iron out?
Yeah,
what
I think a lot.
Your personality strengths were
done a little. I've done a lot recently, so I'd say I kind of went. I was blind for the first 80-90% of my career, just kind of figuring stuff out. Not sponsored, not plugged, but Culture Index is a product and a tool that we've started to use. They're really involved in the Entrepreneurs Organization of Kansas City, and John Conger, who's with that group that has Kansas City and has worked with EOKC for many years. I mean, he's really exposed us to personality profiling. So I really didn't do a lot of that coming out of college, always working for smaller companies that didn't do some of that stuff like some of the larger companies do. And so that's that. Honestly, that tool has helped me tremendously understand who I am at my core, understand who my business partners are, my legacy business partners, some of my key employees, my spouse. It's helped tremendously just kind of figure out like, hey, you know, we can be anyone we want to be in a moment, right? We can overcome our weakness in a moment, but here's kind of your default, right? If nothing else happens and you just roll out of bed, here's kind of who you are and what you're good at, what you're not good at. That's been tremendously helpful. And then, I mean, I've also worked with a mental health coach for the last several years and some form of therapy, right? And so trying to work with a mental health coach and start to understand situations and interpersonal relationships been tremendously helpful. And then my involvement in NEO, an entrepreneurs organization, that forum experience that you and I have talked a little bit about, that's also been tremendous, right? To have a group of peers to really dive into that 5% that you can't share with the rest of the public. And so these are all things that have kind of just been layering over the top of each other for the last 5-6 years, that I can't really point to any one thing, but it's definitely something I found more recently in my career than I ever understood or, you know, knew it in my 20s and 30s. So.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. Because, I mean, is it safe to assume as you start to peel away the layers of the onion, right, you start to kind of wonder like, wow, what would it have been like had I realized some of these things years ago, right? Okay, so you're in sales. You find out you're a better farmer than hunter. But it sounds like you do all right for yourself because you end up managing the department, essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said you received a management position there for a little bit of a sizable. So kind of walk me through, how did they notice you? What was it, you know, you did all right, it sounds like, in that role.
We did. I don't remember the specifics. We either did monthly awards. I think we did monthly awards, and I think we did semester. We operated on semesters, right? There was fall, spring, summer semesters of staff because we did have a summer. We did put out a summer newspaper at KU in the summers, just less frequent. But I don't remember. I probably have it in a memory box somewhere, but I received an award for like account rep of the semester. I was rewarded with something at the semester end party. And that was like my first moment of like, oh, like I wasn't working hard for anyone else. I was just working hard because that's what I was, you know, raised to do. If you're going to do something, you know, give it 100%, put everything you have into it. And so I remember in certain meetings, I remember in that little award ceremony, I was starting to be called out for my actions in a positive way. And I remember thinking like, I didn't ask for this. I don't want this. I don't want to, like, was used as an example for other people. Like, you should be doing more of this. And I'm like, that's not why I'm doing it. I didn't even realize that, but I think that it did help. I mean, it did help validate that I was doing the right things. And I think I started to get a little bit of confidence and like, oh, okay, you know what you're doing. You do know how to run this territory. You do know how to make sales, whatever it is. And so, yeah, there was different layers of management. I just started applying. You had to go through an application process. I mean, to be the business manager, you met with like a board and other professors. And that was, you know, that first big position. And the business manager hired their staff. And so obviously the business manager started, you know, they hired a sales manager and then they started to build out their team. And so every semester you re-interviewed for a job, like you interviewed for maybe the position above you, similar to corporate America, similar to the real world, but it was just in a lot more rapid fire. Every semester was a reset. And so, just over the first couple of years, just started, you know, working my way up through middle management until I sat in that business manager seat. You know, looking back at the moment, I wasn't being driven by anything other than I just wanted to keep advancing and continue to add to that resume. And I was super enjoying being on staff. Again, it wasn't until recently I've started to reflect on that experience and realize how many real world skills I was gaining every semester, every month that was going to eventually apply to my professional life or apply to the real world. But I didn't realize what I was doing in real time. Honestly, I was just working for the newspaper, having fun. I mean, we made money, right? So I needed an income. So this is what I did to build the resume and make some beer money. I mean, and meet friends every semester. And I don't know, it was natural. It wasn't real intentional. And meanwhile, I was also involved in AKSI, and I was working my way up and became president of that organization for a semester. And I was at an EO event recently, and I was like, I didn't realize it, but I was running a $1 million business and president of a chapter. Literally what I just did a couple years ago with EO is, you know, running a company and being president of EOKC. And so, oh man, it's kind of weird. The universe is sending you signals, and sometimes it takes 20 years to notice them, but that's been my experience with that. So
did you ever struggle with imposter syndrome during all that? Sounds like it was a relatively fast track sort of an ordeal.
I really did. I definitely do now. I like most entrepreneurs and most business owners, I would say I feel that now more than ever, but I don't know if I don't remember feeling that way at that point in my life for whatever reason. It's a good question. I don't know why. So for the, I think about that.
Well, it sounds like you were driven. Was there ever a moment where, I mean, and maybe there's a lot of vacations in there, I don't know, but just based off how you're describing it, my guess is not a lot of vacations, not a lot of personal time necessarily, a lot more work. Did you ever have a moment where you're like, man, what did I just spend the last 5 years
after
doing?
College, I did. I definitely, as I look back, and it's funny, if I have a regret, I wish I would have maybe slow down and enjoyed college more. I mean, I definitely was not, you know, in the library. So I definitely enjoyed myself some, but like I wish I would have traveled more. I didn't take a lot of trips. Kind of broke. I mean, honestly, man, I was my parents helped me with some of the college expenses, but I just didn't have the money to do a lot of crazy stuff and take crazy spring break trips and stuff. So, you know, I hung out in Lawrence quite a bit in the summers and on breaks. Not a lot of goofing off other than, I mean, obviously the evenings, I definitely walked up and down Mass Street plenty. It's not like I completely just worked all, it took me 5 years. So I took my time. So.
Gotcha. Okay. So tell me about kind of the progression out of that then. Because obviously you've held multiple roles. So you were you were business manager at that organization. Tell me about kind of your next transition from that and what that looked like and what sparked that.
Yeah, I got one of the summers. I earned a pretty competitive position at Hallmark. So I had a marketing internship at Hallmark one summer. Where looking back, it's definitely something I didn't put my all into. I definitely, for whatever reason, I don't think it was a good fit. And so, you know, being young and arrogant, I just kind of, I showed up every day, but, you know, I definitely wasn't 100% bought in. But also looking back, I think I also knew at a really young age that I didn't like working at mega large companies. Like, I mean, we literally, you know, you had a badge to get in and get out of the building, and you had just cubicle city. And this is not the Hallmark today. This is Hallmark, you know, when cards were still thriving and email hadn't taken over and text messages didn't exist. But I didn't know how to articulate it. I don't think I knew it in the moment how to describe what I was going through, but I definitely did not like working for a mega company, you know, where there was just layers and layers of management and where you were just one of thousands of employees. And so that was definitely extremely helpful. I had a great manager and mentor that summer who, looking back, was really hard on me, but hard on me in a good way. You know, like, I was young, I was arrogant, and he definitely, I mean, he's, you know, I still remember conversations and stuff that, that have stuck with me still to this day. And so I'm so grateful for Phil and what everything he did that summer, because I think I was just some punk kid that was just, you know, going through this internship with the other interns and partying at events. Phil obviously kind of leaned into me when for the better. But I knew I wasn't going to go that route. At the end of college, went to the Career Center, just reviewing open positions in the Johnson County and Kansas City area. Was dating my now wife, but dating than a girlfriend who was a year older than me, and she was living in Kansas City. And so I wanted to stay in KC because that relationship was getting kind of serious, got real serious a couple of years later. We're going to celebrate 19 years here soon. So I knew I wanted to be in Kansas City.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And found an opening at the Kansas City Bar Association, the Metro Bar Association that serviced attorneys in Kansas City. And it was a role. It was a new role. They were building it from scratch, and it was a vendor relation role. So it was selling advertising, like the print ads in their monthly magazine, selling sponsorships, selling exhibit booths at the trade shows that the KCMBA puts on. And so there was this really natural progression of like what I'd been doing in college. So I'm like, well, this is exactly what I've been doing, is, you know, print ads and sponsorships and things like that. And I saw it as a new role. And thought, I can put my spin on this. I get some creative freedom. It was a small staff. It was like 14, 15 people. And so it kind of checked all the boxes. Now, I had no idea I didn't know anything about legal. Like, I had no aspirations of being a lawyer. So I was like, well, I'll learn whatever the law, the legal aspect of this. I'll learn this industry, but the job itself felt really natural and easy kind of to slide into, because there were so many similarities between that role and then the UDK, working at the UDK in college.
Okay. So tell me about that though, aspect of it. So you're doing sales now for the Bar Association, essentially.
Yep.
And now I'm kind of interested to hear too, law in general seems to have this interesting take on sales and marketing. And so I'm kind of interested in hearing was there a lot of guardrails you had to operate within, or because you were more on the sales side than the marketing side, was it relatively easy for you to like?
We weren't really discussing guardrails. This was mainly vendors that wanted to reach attorneys in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And so it started with court reporting and litigation support, what I do now, and services that service law firms, phone systems or IT companies and different outfits. We started to dabble in like, you know, BMW or Lexus, or what are some of the other companies that want to sell product to an affluent group of individuals. And so we were looking at other outside of just legal, but like, this is a target rich environment in Kansas City. And so what banks, retirement, wealth, financial services, like what are other groups that would want to reach this group of buyers? And then there really wasn't a lot of, this is attorney to attorney advertising. So it wasn't like what you see, like where they have all of the disclaimers and, you know, the decision of a lawyer is important. A lot of mediation though, a lot of like, mediation services that attorney based mediation practices will want to sell to other lawyers. So, it was not lawyer to consumer. It was to the attorneys themselves. So no, we didn't really have a lot of, guardrails or anything that we got to kind of live in.
Gotcha. Okay. So I'm going to skip forward a little bit because I do want to talk about something we haven't really discussed much on the podcast in general. And I don't know if we discuss much as entrepreneurs in general. So you mentioned you're celebrating going on 19 years now, correct? And right. And you discussed an entrepreneurial spirit hidden in there, but a lot of what I'm hearing up to, you know, maybe more recent years is a little bit more of a traditional, albeit kind of sales path. Uh-huh. What was it like relationally transitioning back into that entrepreneurial spirit? Because founder of a business, it hits different.
Yeah, I love this question because, I started dating my wife and we got married very early in our careers, obviously, and we started to build our life together as we started to build our careers together. And when I got into this industry, I was in this industry for about 8 years. And in that time, I stayed physically I stayed in one physical office, though I worked for three separate companies because we were constantly being bought and sold, right? Merged and bought, sold, different private equity transactions. So sometimes we wouldn't change our logo, but the ownership structure did change behind the scenes. And so For those 8 years, I lived quite a bit of chaos, and definitely towards the end was very chaotic. I was traveling a lot. I was in a national role. Was not home a lot. Put a lot of strain on my marriage, put a lot of strain on my relationship. I had young kids. My boys were very young back then. And so when I left that organization and went back to a large company, I went into account management, client management role, sales role. I promised my wife I'd give her 3 years. 3 years of stability, nice corporate job, great benefits. And then we would get our kids. I think the timing was to get the youngest to kindergarten, and then maybe I could do something or fulfill that entrepreneurial itch. We'd gotten close before, hadn't ever pulled the trigger. And 2014, myself, my two original business partners, we start Complete Legal. We start working on that. We're getting ready to launch. Hire a couple people. We're not going to quit our day jobs, but we're going to run the company off to the side. And I remember just being petrified to have to tell my wife, like, I told you I'd give you 3 years, but 6 months in, I'm already kind of like going to do this thing. And we were driving to Wichita, and I was like, hey, I got something I want to talk to you about. We had an idea. We've put some action behind it. And my wife just looks at me and says, no, I get it. And I was like, you're not mad. You're not freaked out. And she just looks at me and she goes, I know who I married. And I don't know. She just like peace came over me, like all of a sudden that I just had her blessing right away. And I have to give credit to her father, my father-in-law. You know, my wife grew up in a house where he was an entrepreneur. He ran his own business from his early 20s and up until the year before he passed away. And my wife was an only child raised by her father, and he worked 12-hour days, and then she worked on job sites. He was in residential construction, and she spent many Saturdays on job sites with him as he would go out on weekends and get some and do some additional work. And she would see him keeping the books and doing payroll at home. And so for her, it was her normal, right? So she only knew, she was brought up in a home where the entrepreneur, like that entrepreneurship was the norm. And so, you know, I have to give credit to Paul. He really laid that foundation to normalize this life, or this professional life, for my wife, which then allowed me to go chase my dream and fulfill it, and then have her blessing along the way, which is not always the case, right? And in EO, we talk often that the spouses don't understand the entrepreneur, but that's not my situation, and I'm forever grateful for it. So
that's cool. There was a business coach early on that really kind of helped me hardcore, because she was, you know, the question was pretty basic in her mind. It's probably something she'd heard a lot of, which was, well, have you always been an entrepreneur, like before you were married, or did you become an entrepreneur after? And I was like, after. And she's like, okay, well, you realize you completely changed the rule book on her, yeah, right? Like, I mean, she had a set of rules. There was a rule book, relatively standard, and you know, you flipped it on its head. And I needed to hear that at the time, because there was, as soon as she said that, it was like, oh, I guess I have, haven't I? So
I think in my situation, I'd be curious for your, in my situation, I think for a lot of us, being an entrepreneur is like, the day I got married, there was an entrepreneurial spirit in me, right? Like,
yeah,
I was going to work and drawing a W-2 paycheck because I needed an income. I needed to help pay for mortgage and get this life going. But I think in some ways my wife was acknowledging, like, you've always been an entrepreneur. You just finally have, you know, where life and timing and, you know, money and all the things you need to start a business experience in the industry. I mean, there's no Complete Legal if I don't get 8 years of experience working for somebody else. And my, you know, I worked alongside and worked for my legacy business partner for all those years. And so I've always been an entrepreneur, since I was little, on that first mowing route. Right. But, I think one of the things we don't talk about is like sometimes you've got to put in some work, and some work might be working in your industry, working for somebody else, waiting for life to be at that perfect spot. Then you can actually, like, you know, execute it. It's, you know, fulfill that dream. Right. I think that's something else we glamorize. You talk about Shark Tank. Like, I think sometimes we glamorize, like, 20 somethings just think that they should be able to start a business, and some can. Some have amazing ideas, especially with the world of software and technology. Absolutely. But I don't think we talk about like committing to a career, learning a craft, and then figuring out how you're going to do it better, differently, and do it for yourself, which to me is more of a normal story. And the young entrepreneurs in their early 20s is the exception. And there's some fascinating ones out there, but those become the exception, not the norm for most of us. So,
well, we live in this really interesting world now, right? Where the algorithm on social media feeds us the exception, the exception, the exception, the exception, because that's, you're right, that's what we're interested in. We're fascinating in the exception and how they figured it out. And it creates this world, this dysfunction in our mind, for lack of any better term, where you forget the fact that it's the exception. You forget the fact that, and frankly, that's, you know, part of the value of the podcast is the, and what I'm after is, yeah, but there was shit involved. Even in your 20s, like there's real stuff they had to go through. Of that, I have no doubt. Get one of them on and we'll find out that it's like, well, they probably had to interview 100 investors or whatever, 90 of which probably didn't give them the time of day just because their age, if nothing else. And then, you know, they spent 12 hours, 7 days a week with a chip on their shoulder just to try to get,
yeah, and I
get
think
it
that,
across the finish line.
You know, the exceptions are inventors, right? If you can make something and then you can, like, again, that's where an idea is valuable, right? I invented this thing. Fund it and we could build this, right? That's Shark Tank a lot. I've built this. I just need the money to scale it now. Those definitely exist, man. They're fascinating. And we definitely don't, we live in a crazy time where with online influencers, you can absolutely be your own brand, start your own business with nothing more than a cell phone. And there are clearly a lot of people making a lot of money as influencers, as content creators, whatever. But again, to your point, exception, not the rule, right? For every person out there making millions of dollars as an online influencer or content creator, it's probably what, 100,000 that aren't, right? That are trying to figure out how to get it going. I had this debate with a younger person the other day, and she's like, I just don't know how to get ahead and how to get my, you know, my side hustle going. And she's very young. And I was like, I don't think we talk about committing to a career, you know, throwing yourself at a company, at a career, learning skills, and then applying those later in life. Like there's this, you know, she was all torn up because she's like, you know, she's in her early 20s and she doesn't have three businesses and a commercial real estate portfolio. And I'm like, you're not really supposed to at 24 years old. Like it's not, I mean, yeah, some can and some do, but you know, most of us have to go get a job and figure out what we're going to do with that entrepreneurial spirit at some point later in life when things are aligned. But
when I really like the transition that you've kind of described is you and some colleagues along your full-time role, which is, you know, creating this thing, eventing this thing, working this thing, and then eventually transitioning to that thing. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I'd transition way faster than we thought. We thought we'd run this business. We'd hire a couple people, run the business for a year or two, kind of, you know, put our toe in the water. We used to call it, we were like mailbox money. If we can just make a little money on the side, it'd be really, really cool. And it lasted 3 months. I mean, it lasted a month or two. Our two employees, one of them who's still with us today, we're coming up on 11 years in business and we still have one of our first employees. They sat us down and said, hey, the demand is high. Our old clients want to come back to us. I mean, again, we had left the industry. We'd sat out our non-competes. We didn't have non-compete issues with the folks we hired. And so, they sat us down and said, hey, this thing could really take off, but you guys can't just kind of like passively invest or put your toe in the water. We were going to manage it on the side, you know, keep our day jobs, something to do in the afternoons, evenings. And so that was another moment I had to go back to my wife and say, hey, thanks for blessing starting the thing. Now I want to quit my full-time job and I want to go to work for the company that we started. So I was not employee number one. I think I was employee four, if I remember.
And you had said you were going to give it of what, a four-year runway, I think you had discussed, and now you're a couple, one to two years.
Well, I originally promised my wife 3 years, and then we thought we're gonna run this thing for a couple of years, and and then I gave her like 2 or 3 months. We launched in September, and I asked over Thanksgiving if I could quit my job.
So if we include the 6 months into the, that's like nine, maybe, it's fascinating. Okay. So
yeah, I end up working.
And those conversations, there's, you know, she's blessing each one.
Yeah. We had her family. I still remember I met with my other partners for a beer, right before the Thanksgiving weekend. Hey, do we want to do this? I'll quit. Can we pay me X? I got to make at least X to like pay my mortgage. But if we do that, I can quit, start Jan 1, whatever. We agreed we could figure it out. Went home, got my wife's blessing. And then as her family came to town, we were sharing the news. Eric's quitting his job. He's going full time. Everyone was so excited. Everyone was so happy except for me. I was effing miserable. I was scared shitless. I couldn't have been further from happiness. Just like, oh my God, what are you doing? What have you done? You're giving up a sure thing paycheck. You're giving up your benefits. You're giving up your health insurance, your retirement. Just, I mean, you want to talk about self-doubt. Like, I've never been full of more self-doubt than probably that Thanksgiving weekend of 2014. It was scary. Everyone else was happy except for me.
That's a fascinating concept, because looking back, how would you treat yourself now looking back?
I don't know if it would be, you know, now I have the confidence, and I don't remember I was consuming books back then, like, you know, startup books, business books, things like E-Myth, like everything I get my hands on. Quitter by, I think, John Acuff, just all sorts of different material. I don't remember the author. I don't remember the book, but someone said, write. Journal. I was not a journaler. I never journaled, but it said, journal your fears and read them out loud. Fears are eliminated by being brought out of the darkness into the light, or something to that effect. And so for the first time, I started journaling my fears, and I still have that. I have that journal somewhere. I'm not sure. I think it's at home in my home office, but, you know, what if I fail? What if I fail my partners? What if I fail my employees? What if I fail? What will I do to my family? Like all of those, just the fears and thoughts, I just dumped them out on paper. And I just read them. I just read them out loud. And I started to, I neutralized them, right? Like, I think it was, you know, looking back, it was probably just a lack of confidence, but rightfully so. I'd never done this before. I'd never run a business before. So why would you have confidence other than maybe just pure, pure belief in yourself? But I didn't have anything to compare it to. And so, journaling helped quite a bit. And then just doing something about it, putting action behind it, just, you know, going to work. That January 3rd or whatever it was, rolling into the office and started making a to-do list of, what do we need to do to start building this company? What do we need to do to build revenue? I mean, luckily I'd been in the industry before. I had old clients in the KC area, started making a old list of clients I could call on again that I hadn't seen for a while. Maybe I hadn't seen for a couple of years. And so, you know, I still struggle with this today, but, you know, just start creating action, start making to-dos and start working towards something. And for me, that's what helps eliminate that angst, which is taking control. And you can only take control by putting something into action.
How did COVID treat y'all?
Weird. Scary. There's the first 4 to 6 weeks that were really nasty. Sent employees home. You know, we have employees that scan and print documents. And so we had to sent equipment to people's houses. We sent documents for them to scan. And for the first 6 weeks, four to six weeks, it was really scary. It was, you know, it was like everybody else, the uncertainty, having Zoom calls, having not be the norm back until then. And then we actually grew during COVID. We actually grew year over year for the first 8 years, which includes the through COVID years. So, you know, we had a couple cases fall our way. We had, you know, just without getting into the weeds of our business, we had some of our electronic work pick up because lawyers were working from home and they needed ways to bill hours. I mean, lawyers weren't bringing in new cases, so we weren't bringing in new cases. It made a really bad pipeline issue that didn't bite us until like 2020, 2023 is when COVID finally kind of really caught up with us, which was hard because all of the subsidies and government programs had long expired. But, you know, it's COVID impacted our 2023 results, though it was enough removed that kind of the world was back to normal. But if you really look at our business and our pipeline and everything that put into motion, yeah, it was great. 20, 21, even 22, they were fine. They're great. We grew. But it finally caught up to us in 23. So
what was it like? Sorry, this made me think of this as well. What was it like when the state of Kansas got hacked? Man, there was that stint there where it seemed like all our firms on the Kansas side were just faxing. That's all they were. That was the only thing they
got. I don't
got
remember
anything.
That. So you're the IT guy. You would remember that more than I do. I don't remember. What time was this? What year was this?
What? Gosh, you know, you'd think I'd remember the year. It wasn't that long ago. Had to have been 23 or 24. And that's where I just wasn't curious if it would have affected your guys' stuff significantly necessarily or not. But
the significantly larger companies in our space have evolved into cyber response or some sort of cyber. We just haven't evolved there yet, or I'm not sure if we ever will. So there's just, though we're aware, we do work on some litigation that involves cyber attacks. It's not our day to day, our bread and butter. So
I'm probably not going to do it full justice, but there was a stint there where the entire Kansas legal system, the only way they were capable of moving forward at all, because the actual judiciary, like the only way CaseNet was like all these things were down. Probably due to ransomware, theoretically.
Okay.
And the only way anybody was capable of moving forward was individual firms were faxing the needed discovery documents and things like that.
Filing court
to
filing.
The court. Yeah.
And you're not seeing your room. Now you're sparking memories that I've long suppressed. Yeah. Cases were not.
Sorry.
I'm kind of blacked out these years. Yes, I do remember cases were moving even before the cyber attack on Kansas. The cases were moving extremely slow in 2000, 2001. I remember lawyers complaining that because they weren't being able to do normal hearings in person, things just weren't getting done. A lot of judges weren't doing what they should be doing via Zoom that they would do in person. And so things were coming to a screeching halt. And you have to remember too, like, I mean, what our norm is even now, we were learning to be a Zoom culture, right? Back then, especially court systems, judges tend to be older. Courts tend to be very dated. I mean, obviously your federal courts are modernized, but I mean, most of your average courthouses and judges are not terribly tech savvy. So, even though we were able to grow, there was definitely just kind of this screeching halt of cases and stuff where we would normally kind of keep things moving. I do remember like we were just, yes, painfully slow. But that, you know, e-filing and things like that. I mean, that I needed an attorney to check me here, but states like Missouri haven't been e-filing for that long. So it wasn't that many years ago. The norm was to still have to go to the courthouse, you know, file your petition, do whatever. And so e-filing has, you know, it's definitely sped things up and it's allowed firms to be able to move away from downtown courthouses and just be anywhere in the metro. But yeah, it's funny that things have changed a lot the last several years. Stuff that I kind of take for granted, I think, till you take me down these COVID rabbit holes.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry. It's just sometimes the questions, they start flowing. Like, for example, this next one, wild, and it's going to take us a little bit political, but it's an interesting notion because, you talk about the legal system and e-filing being relatively recent. And my reason for asking is you obviously have a lot more exposure in the legal space, but then also in the tech side of the legal space as well. It's interesting to me that we have, even just like in the Senate or the House, we have these senators and representatives that don't have any understanding how technology works. And we've been kind of propelled into this world where we really need to start to regulate things like social media and TikTok. It's really starting to come to the forefront of people's exposure of like the damage it does to teenagers during their mental growth track. And I wish I had a question there. Maybe it's more of a statement giving you an opportunity to weigh in on if you have your thoughts there. Because I just don't know. Like you said, you know, judges and these are older folks that have been in the legal system for forever. And we have a whole system designed on that. The Supreme Court, right, is lifetime appointment. And I like the notion that I think an old America was like, hey, you know, we should have these older folks that have more wisdom and years and understanding.
Matters, right? Yeah.
Yes, 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 yes. And I still love that premise. Side item, we now have a world where you watch some of these Senate hearings and it's clear they have no idea how a social media algorithm works, even at a base level understanding. They're over there like, why is my feed full of all these anti-socialist political? And it's like, okay, you just admitted to watching a lot of anti-socialist political that's why the algorithm's feeding you that. So anyway, yeah, I mean, sorry.
It's interesting. It's something we discuss. I mean, AI, I mean, I know we're AI will eventually be the meteor that hits our planet, right? In our industry,
it's definitely gonna
revolutionize my industry at some point. But we often discuss that it's going to be very delayed, and that's partially because just even the technology that's been available for the last 10 or 15 years hasn't been adopted, and stuff that's precursor to AI, and even just I told you, like, my industry's gone from scanning records to pulling data off of devices. And so it's challenging when your seasoned litigator is older, when the judge is potentially older than him or her. And so the judge doesn't fully understand the technology. The lawyer may or may not understand the technology. And so it's hard to make rulings that are technology sound. I'm not going to get into the if it's legally sound or not from decision to decision, but from a technology standpoint, there's a lot of stuff that gets overlooked or ruled incorrectly, or folks from my team have been called to testify on very, very simplistic concepts, like extremely simplistic concepts about altering cells in a spreadsheet, for example, right? And so though technology and AI is kind of looming, right, like we still have this very antiquated judiciary system and legal system, and it's not so much about the practice of law, it's just really the understanding of technology. And so I, in my humble opinion, until that head litigator, but more importantly, until that judge is someone who grew up with technology and really isn't scared to learn about it or understands it, I don't think we're going to see a huge change in our space. I think AI is going to be kept at arm's length, or any type of machine assistance will be kept at arm's length until we have a kind of a turnover of those roles, and because they're generational, like it's a generational difference. And I'm officially at the age where I'm starting to, like, you know, be stuck in my ways or not want to adapt. So I get it, right? Like, I can, you know, I go through life now having to do self-checkouts, finding myself getting angry. So I'm like, okay, I'm the angry old man some days, but it's a challenge.
Well, I think we all probably get there sooner or later, for sure. I make the joke to folks that, you know, one of these days I'm going to have kids and they're going to send me a virtual reality headset. All right, Dad, we're all getting together for Thanksgiving, and I'm going to be there like, okay, I'm waiting at the door. It's like,
house.
No, you're supposed to put on the headset. Yeah. It's like, no. This isn't, I'm not doing this. I'm not entering your virtual reality world to have virtual Thanksgiving turkey. I want real food with a real family. Let's do that, please.
All right. So you're not going to the metaverse, and I'm tired of checking myself out. We've got some pretty different bars. But at least we've established our boundaries.
I don't know. The self-checkout, for some reason, does not bother me as much. And I think that has more to do with the fact that, like, or the McDonald's thing. You know, people, and my older brother, he gets grumpy at me. He's like, man, I just, you know, what are they doing? It's taking their jobs. And I'm over here like, well, did they ever get your order right anyway? And he's like, no, they never did. I was like, okay, so how often is your order wrong now? He's like, well, a lot less often. I'm like, all right, so what's your point? You know, they didn't want to work the job, and you didn't want to have them take your order. So
I'm just at the place where I want the option. I don't mind. I'll use a self-checkout at the grocery store if I've got one item, but the fact that they still have cashiers makes me happy. So the stores that only deploy the self-checkout is where I get mad, because there might be a situation where it's just, you need help. And I've noticed too with traveling, they have self-checkouts with an employee standing next to it to help you, like teach you what to do. And I'm like, if you're already paying someone, you're employing someone, just have them, you know, why are we asked to do all the work ourselves? But that's, you know, I'm just getting stubborn.
I fantasize of a world where this was more popular, because for me, the only time I really get that experience, I'm 32. I think for me, the only time I've ever really gotten the experience that maybe you're kind of describing is at a fancy upscale restaurant, right? Where their hospitality and customer service is what they do. And so, they're out of your way, like you hint at a need or whatever, and next thing you know, it's taken care of. Versus, the world where we're at now, where it's like, we want everything to be done over a machine. Also, because we handed you your drink, did you tip us a minimum of 20%? And it's like, what happened?
We just got back from a summer vacation in Portugal, and coming back to the first airport we hit back in the U.S., we were reflecting on the service we got, especially at some of one of the last resorts we were at, and how we tipped. They just built in a 5% or 10% tip, and you got phenomenal service. And then we were back in the U.S., and I'm like, we literally had to QR code, order our own food. We literally had a runner just bring it over, and then a guy, get a prompt that if you don't, you're going to be auto-billed in 15 minutes if you don't close your tab. And then the first question was, do you want to tip 22%? I'm like, for what? So I think that's, the grumpy man, get off my lawn. But I think we're at a weird impasse where, I'm a big believer in tipping, obviously. But how much work are we doing as the consumer? How much are we placing the order, picking up our food or whatever it is? And then we're also tipping as if we got full service. And I think for a lot of us, we still want to tip because we know it's someone's job. But like, I don't know, we're at a weird place where technology is going to start. These types of things are going to literally start to put people out of work. That's going to be interesting. And then will we still have such a strong tipping culture if we're doing a lot of the work ourselves as a consumer? I don't know. That'll be interesting. But it was, having not been to Europe for a while, it was fascinating. It was a good reminder to be there and then kind of come back to the U.S. and in a post-COVID world, how we are kind of expected to do a lot more for ourselves with QR codes and ordering food and all that kind of stuff. So a lot more self-service than it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot more self-service than it used to be. So we should probably talk about Entrepreneurs Organization a little bit.
Yeah,
I feel
absolutely.
Like that was obviously a key aspect of what you've done throughout your career. And you've hinted at it a couple times. I can tell you're partial to it, to say the least. So can you kind of describe for those that don't know what the Entrepreneurial Organization is?
Yeah. Entrepreneurs Organization, or routinely called EO, Global Association, made up of about 19,000 entrepreneurs and business founders across the world. We've got 200 and some chapters across the world, 50, 60 countries, I think. And it's just, it's a peer group. And I think we were talking before the pod started recording, there are so many opportunities. There's so many associations and programs that are out there, especially in Kansas City. And I'm a big believer in every business owner, entrepreneur, executive, finding the group that makes sense for them, that serves their need, and a group where they can really plug in, get mentorship or peer-to-peer experiences. And so for me, EO has been a godsend and I've absolutely loved it, but I recognize that there's a lot of great programs out there, YPO, Hemp, Vistage, and again, go where it makes sense. I joined EO actually literally right before the pandemic, a few months before the pandemic, which was a great time and a horrible time. It was bad for, being a normal member and experiencing that, but it was also a great time to be with peers as we went through all that uncertainty. So, it's a peer group, non-for-profit association. We have several different concepts, but really there's a few that are just like, we have the Aform experience where you get together with a small group once a month. It's 100% confidential. We have structure. It's electronic free. food and electronics free. So you're forced to unplug and really just talk about yourself as a person, as an entrepreneur, spouse, parent, community leader. You know, we wear a lot of hats, right? And those hats get very blended. You don't get to just take off one hat and then go home and put on the other hat. Like, obviously, when you're an entrepreneur and business owner, you are that. Everywhere you go, you might run into clients and employees and things like that. So it can get heavy, right? And so sometimes we need to unplug and talk to our peers about what we're going through. And so that's a part of EO. We also have some awesome learning events. I know you've been able to attend a couple of those where we bring in speakers and just get together and do some general learning and have a social aspect of hanging out, but also getting some content, investing in ourselves. And then we have leadership roles. And so that's actually, there's paths of leadership. I was able to serve as president in Kansas City. I was able to serve on the regional board the last couple of years and just cycled off that role. And so there's also leadership roles if that speaks to you. So there's a lot of continuing ed and things that you can just invest in yourself, right? So there's summer school programs at MIT. And so you can also just become a student of entrepreneurialism and then through the association.
How do you manage all of this? This is I'm cheating now. I'm asking my own selfish questions. So it seems to me, right? It just as time goes on and I fantasize of a world without the smartphone because, you know, you're so accessible via text message. You're so accessible via email. You know, we have Microsoft Teams chat, Slack channels, Google Workspace, pick your poison. And that never mind Messenger, never mind LinkedIn. And these are just dinging. These aren't even like responsibilities that we've signed on for.
Yeah.
And what made me think about that is the volunteer for the EO. And normally when you volunteer, when I've ever volunteered for something like that, there's an expectation of like a year or two of service, right? So you're going to, at a bare minimum, you got to give this thing a real go for a year or two, despite surgery, despite, you know, whatever else might be going on in your life. How the heck are you managing all that? How are you making sure balls don't get dropped? How are you finding a good 8 hours of sleep every night?
It's been a process. It's something I struggled with early on in my career, early on as an entrepreneur and business owner. Something that EO's helped me figure out. One of the first things we do as EO members is say you're going to lock yourself in a room for half a day once a month with your phone down to work on yourself. And we all go into that kicking and screaming and we say, I can't do that. I'm too important. I can't be unavailable. And then you realize that if you went into business to have some control and autonomy over your day, and if you can't give yourself a half day a month, you're probably doing it wrong. Like you realize, like, I went into this so I could be my own boss and have control. And if you don't have the ability to pre-plan a half day to continue to be, I mean, we do check our phone, like we on breaks and stuff, of course, but like it, and that's kind of the shift that first starts as an EO member. You're like, no, I do need to make time for myself. I do need to unplug. I do need to learn from peers. And this is stuff that I'm going to learn from folks and then take this to my business and make my business better. So like you actually realize that you're investing in yourself and you're investing in your business by making some time. So EO's helped tremendously, but yeah, there's other folks I've worked with, coaches, that have helped me understand just the importance of putting yourself first. And so for me, it does start with that. It do get your 8 hours of sleep. I work out in the afternoons. I've played with times of day that I enjoy working out. For me, at the end of a work day is the best. It lets me burn off that day mentally and kind of go home, kind of cleanse. My brain's kind of cleansed. And so that's become a big part of my process. Go for walks, sit in saunas, meditate, all stuff I was not doing 5 years ago. But finding time to clear your head, finding time to get your thoughts straight. And then you just start, you just old fashioned prioritization. You just get your days planned. You make time for EO. You make time for work. You make time for your employees. You make time for your kids. I mean, I was at a doctor's appointment yesterday afternoon with my family, right? And missing internal calls. I used to coach baseball, you know, and so I would leave work and go hit the field and coach little kids and help run that team for several years. And so, I don't know, you just start to figure out, you got to put yourself first at times. You've got to put your family first at times. You put your company first at times. I think if you, for me, if I've, day to day, week to week, like the company doesn't always win, or the family doesn't always win, or I don't know. It's a give and take, but I don't know. And it's for me, it's true. The busier you get, the more efficient you get. You don't want to waste time, right? So do I need to be on that call? Do I need to be at that meeting? Can I do it via Teams or Zoom instead of going in person? And so you become more efficient when your time is limited. It's worked for me. How about that? And it's definitely been an evolution, and that's definitely something I've gotten more into the last few years, not like all 10 or 11 that we've had the business. So this is a more recent learned behaviors.
So to that end, what's one of the more difficult lessons you felt you've had to learn? Maybe it was an easy lesson you had to learn the hard way.
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one, because there's probably so many. This is one of those things that will come to me later today. You know, what out of the first thing that comes to my mind is that people will surprise you, good and bad, right? And so whether that's in your personal life, interpersonal relationships, whether that's employees, whether that's clients, no matter how old I get, people just continually to surprise me for the good and bad, right? So someone isn't who you thought they were as a friend, as an employee, as a manager, whatever. And conversely true, people, I've been blown away with people that will step up in times of need or be there to help, or, you know, be that client that one of those clients you didn't see coming. But people also surprise you for the good, right? And you're like, oh my God, I never saw this person. I didn't realize this person cared this much, right? Whether whatever role they play in your life. And so that's, I think it's the challenge. We're humans, we're not robots. And so we have our own, everyone's going through life dealing with different things. And so people surprise me every day for the good and bad. And so that's been I think that's a challenge, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we can start to move to wrap up. Is there anything you think we might have missed?
I think we covered a lot of stuff, man.
I think so too. So there's two questions we like to ask in wrap up.
Okay.
So the first one is, we have a motto over here that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Okay. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to?
Oh man. It's funny. Some people have like a mentor. I've never felt like I had a mentor, right? I've never had that one constant. But God, I've had so many people in my career and in my personal life that have just like, to me, like everyone just gives me a nugget, right? And at different steps of my career and at different phases. Someone that comes to mind for me is a man named Brad Jenkins. He actually, he was at one point, we were one of his larger clients. He was one of our largest vendors. It was this lovely partnership. He helped us tremendously professionally to help us get the company going with some very favorable pricing to kind of help us out and help us kind of get this part of one of our service lines launched. But he went through his own journey. He was probably 10, 15 at least years ahead of us. He had founded a couple companies. And so he became a great friend. He was always very open with advice, would often understand where we were as a business, even though we were a vendor client. We would both open up on kind of what we were dealing with. And then he's actually the man that got me to EO. So I was out with him one night. I was dumping all my problems on his lap, trying to get him to solve them for me because he's so much wiser than I am. And he's the one that said, hey, you know, I found this group many years ago. It's helped me tremendously. And so he's the one that kind of nudged me to EO. And he has since had his exit. He's had a very successful exit from his company. We don't keep in great touch. We try and connect a few times a year. But definitely someone who I think very, very highly of and do often say mentor, and very grateful for what he's given me over the years and given us as an organization, but me personally.
That's cool. So the other one is, if there's a pithy saying or North Star, general rule of thumb that you've found to be true in your life again and again and again, what would that be?
God, I have sayings that come to me like every week. I have a new theme in my head. It's this week's get comfortable being uncomfortable. And it just, some of the stuff that we're working on in the business, some of the stuff that I'm dealing with the company, That one hit me yesterday. It was just like, get comfortable being uncomfortable. We're doing some stuff that's got me uncomfortable, but that's where growth happens. That's where change happens. That's where you get better as a person, as an organization, as a team. And I rip off so many sayings and from people way smarter than me. I'm sure someone has said that somewhere, but that's been ringing in my head the last 24, 48 hours. So I'll use get uncomfortable, get comfortable being uncomfortable.
I love that, Eric. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.